Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Wandering Stars by Tommy Orange. Tommy Orange triumphantly returns with Wandering Stars, the follow-up to his groundbreaking 2018 debut, There, There. Part prequel, part sequel, yet wholly standing on its own, Orange's novel follows the descendants of Jude Starr, a Cheyenne survivor of the 1864 Sand Creek Massacre, for more than a century and a half before catching up with the present day and landing in the aftermath of the first book's harrowing climax. The novel begins with an address on the American government's multi-pronged campaign to eliminate the original inhabitants of these American lands. One such campaign came with the slogan, "Kill the Indian, Save the Man," Orange tells us, referring to the boarding schools where indigenous children were forced to suffer all manners of torture in the name of assimilation. But Orange continues, "All the Indian children who were ever Indian children never stopped being Indian children, whose Indian children went on to have Indian children." In spite of the calculated terror and the incalculable loss, the government's campaign failed and could only ever fail. This framing is part of what's so special about this book. As we move through generations of the family, as stars become bear shields who become red feathers, and even as knowledge of their histories and customs becomes muddled or lost to time and tragedy, Jude Starr's lineage and that of his people remains unbroken. Still, when the novel enters the 21st century, members of the Red Feather family lament society's apparent refusal to see Native Americans as existing in the present day. While watching an Avengers movie, Lonnie, the youngest of the Red Feather brothers, imagines what powers a Native American superhero would have. He makes a list that includes can fly, because feathers, and invisibility, because no one knows we're still here. Orange expands his focus on identity to consider the fraught relationship between race and blood. We hear from a high school student named Sean Price, an adoptee raised by white parents, who has just received the results of his DNA test. He'd already assumed he was part black, Orange writes. There was no mistaking the look you got if you were assumed black or part black in a white community, whether you were or were not all or part. Blackness, according to Sean, lies in others' assumptions and becomes most pressingly about how one is perceived and treated. The point is emphasized when Sean and another adoptee friend make a habit of riding the city bus from the Oakland Hills down into predominantly black neighborhoods, where they are unbothered and where they can disappear completely from the white gaze. But given his upbringing, Sean didn't feel he had the right to belong to any of what it might mean to be black from Oakland. Sean considers what to make of the DNA results, which reveal European, Native American, and African ancestry, and determines that he couldn't pretend to now be Native American, not white either, but he could continue to be considered black, holding the knowledge of his Native American heritage out in front of him like an empty bowl. Data about his ancestry alone isn't enough to allow him to feel he can claim it. Later, Sean seeks guidance from his schoolmate, Orville Redfeather, asking, "So, like, can I say Indian?" To which Orville responds, "If you're Indian." The novel does not include the percentages that typically accompany these DNA test results, perhaps to dissuade readers from attempting to construct Sean's identity on his behalf. It's as if Orange is saying, "You can't decide this for Sean." It'd be a mistake to think that the power of Wandering Stars lies solely in its astute observations, cultural commentary, or historical reclamations, though these aspects of the novel would make reading it very much worthwhile. But make no mistake, this book has action, suspense. The characters are fully formed, and they get going right out of the gate. Our first moments with Jude Starr are heart-pounding, and our final moments with him, as we find him on the cusp of a decision that will forever change his family's fate, will make you want to scream, "Don't do it!" The fact that you'll want to scream, "Do it!" just as strongly, speaks to the power of Orange's storytelling abilities. There, fans will be happy to see the return of the half-sisters, Jackie and Opal, and to have questions from Orange's first novel answered. Will the once-estranged Jackie stick around to help raise her grandsons? Will she relapse again? What led her to run away and leave Opal behind in her teenage years? As the fallout of colonialization and forced assimilation takes its toll on the family, its most definitive impact is addiction. Jude battles alcoholism, and like a family curse, addiction wends its way through his descendants, reaching even the youngest generation of Red Feathers. Sean and Orville become fast friends, having in common dead mothers, recent hospitalizations, and a growing desire to sustain the high they experience via the painkillers they were prescribed for their respective injuries. Add to the boys' blossoming addictions the fact that Sean's adoptive father has become a drug dealer and manufacturer with a seemingly endless supply of pain pills on hand, and the friendship becomes a powder keg. It would be easy to reduce this friendship to its toxic elements, but the boys also share a love for musical instruments and a brotherly love for each other that's difficult to root against. Orange's ability to highlight the contradictory forces that coexist within friendships, familial relationships, and the characters themselves who contend with holding private and public identities makes Wandering Stars a towering achievement. This review was written by Jonathan Escoffrey. He is the author of the linked story collection, If I Survive You, which was nominated for the 2022 National Book Award and a finalist for the 2023 Booker Prize. King Nix by Kirsten Backus. Kirsten Backus has taken her time, 27 years, to produce a follow-up to her acclaimed 1997 debut, Lives of the Monster Dogs. Now a classic of weird fiction, the novel depicted a bioengineered canine society struggling to hold its own in modern-day New York City. Backus's new book, King Nix, again focuses on oddball or marginalized figures. Its narrator, Annie, is the fictionalized wife of Charles Fort, the early 20th century crypto-scientist whose obsessive attempts to catalog and explain anomalous events, rains of frogs, the fall of 1,000 tons of butter, hailstones flavored like oranges, gave us the adjective Fortean to describe paranormal phenomena. Fort's close friend, Theodore Dreiser, strong-armed his own publisher to take on Fort's first work of nonfiction, The Book of the Damned, in 1919. Ever since, Fort and his speculations have cast a long shadow over popular and conspiracy culture. Films like Peter Weir's The Last Wave and Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, television's The X-Files and Stranger Things, Bigfoot and Mothman and Area 51. Yet, of Fort's real wife, Anna, we know virtually nothing. As a young girl, she went to work as a maid in the household of the wealthy Fort family in Albany. She married the middle son, Charles, and the couple moved to the Bronx, where Charles scraped by, writing for newspapers, until the success of The Book of the Damned. Backus's Annie recounts an anomalous adventure of her own, The Strangest Week of My Life. In November 1918, her husband receives a mysterious invitation from the reclusive tycoon Claude Arkell to spend the winter at his remote mansion in the Thousand Islands of upstate New York. Charles can finish The Book of the Damned while Annie keeps him company. Waiting on the dock to catch their boat, the couple learn that, months ago, three girls went missing from the island's Arkell School for Domestic Service, founded by the tycoon's late wife. Arkell and the local police have made no efforts to find them. Charles shrugs off this information, but Annie is disturbed. In the novel's most affecting chapters, she recalls her years in service to Charles' violent and abusive father, where her only friend was another housemaid, Mary, a lost girl who ran away after several months. Annie remains haunted by thoughts of Mary, who reinvokes childhood daydreams of King Nix, a benevolent spirit, conflated with Annie's favorite toy, a tin wind-up bird that, like Mary, disappeared long ago from the Fort's house. On the island, Annie and Charles are met by a factotum wearing a gas mask. Their germaphobe host insists they quarantine in a cabin for 2 weeks. And they're not Arkell's only guests. The neighboring cabin houses another couple. Stella Bixby greets Annie by announcing, "Welcome to hell, by the way." Stella's psychologist husband is also here to finish a book, a monograph on recurring nightmares. He's invented an apparatus that delivers electrical shocks to cure people of bad dreams and has been treating Arkell, whose wife died in a hunting accident. Soon, Annie glimpses famished-looking girls in the woods, one nursing a baby, and enlists Stella to help her save them. Mysterious island, missing girls, magnet in absentia, with a wife killed under suspicious circumstances. Bacchus has all the elements for a compelling gothic noir, but King Nix feels at once over-edged and undercooked. Bacchus piles on a possible ghost, automatons in a secret underground chamber, unsettling glimpses of the Bixby's private life, hypnosis, Annie's nightmarish memories of a rain of blood, a dead private detective, and the disappearance of Arkell's second wife. The intriguing setup is buried under this avalanche of unfortunate events. Bacchus summons her gift for atmospheric prose in a few memorable scenes, but otherwise, King Nix feels flat. Even Charles Fort might be challenged to rationalize its climax. This review was written by Elizabeth Hand, whose most recent novel is A Haunting on the Hill. Shakespeare's Sisters, How Women Wrote the Renaissance by Raimi Targoff. Judith Shakespeare, Virginia Woolf's imaginary sister of the bard, was for years the accepted portrait of the non-existent writer of Renaissance England. In A Room of One's Own, her seminal feminist essay, Woolf concluded that any glimmer of female creativity in Shakespeare's time would have been expunged by a pinched life as a breeding machine of children who so often died, disallowed opinions of her own. Had any woman survived these conditions, wrote Woolf, whatever she had written would have been twisted and deformed, issued from a strained and morbid imagination. Wrong, says the Renaissance scholar Raimi Targoff in Shakespeare's Sisters, her fascinating excavation of four intellectual powerhouse women of the 16th and early 17th centuries. Woolf had just not dug deep enough to find Mary Sidney's sublime translations, Amelia Lanier's groundbreaking poems, or Elizabeth Carey's subversive dramas. She dismissed the fourth, the great diarist Anne Clifford, as trivial, says Targoff, a view not shared by Anne's distant relative, Vida Sackville-West, when she discovered and lovingly edited the diaries in 1923. All Targoff's subjects, except for the court musician's daughter, Lanier, were well-born women. The female literacy rate in Renaissance England was, by some calculations, below 10% outside London. So there is little chance of a hidden masterpiece emerging from the ruins of a pigsty on Pudding Lane. But aristocratic life for women with an educated mind offered its own special torture. They had to watch the men of the family leave home for the schooling they were denied, and could be married off early to tyrannical dullards. Mary Sidney was only 15 when she was picked to breed by a dour 38-year-old widower, the Earl of Pembroke, and to take on the responsibilities as chatelaine of one of England's grandest stately homes. Elizabeth Carey's husband, Sir Henry, with whom she churned out 11 children, was a dead weight on his wife's soaring talent as a playwright. He forced her to ride, despite her terror of horses. When he left for 2 years to fight in Protestant wars in the Netherlands, his mother hired someone to write letters to him in Elizabeth's name, in case her husband found her obvious intelligence repellent. The cruel certainties and caprices of primogeniture were an occupational hazard for aristocratic women. Anne Clifford battled for 4 bitter decades to reverse her exclusion from her father's will. In clear breach of an entail, it left the entirety of his vast northern estates to his brother. Defying her husband, and even the king, she eventually won and took possession of all 5 of the family's crumbling castles. The exhaustive search through records and legal claims that spurred the rich detail of her autobiographical writing was, in truth, a lifelong effort to validate her right to exist. If Elizabethan noblewomen had looked for a contemporary role model in Queen Elizabeth I, they would have been disappointed. The Queen, in her own speech, played her gender as an anomaly. As Targoff points out, Elizabeth had little in common with most women of the era. The Virgin Queen, after all, was never forced to submit to a husband who controlled all legal rights over her person and her property, never experienced motherhood or the pain of a child's loss. It is as an Alpha scholar and writer that Elizabeth I earns a chapter in this study, crafting translations into Latin, French, and Italian from the age of 12, and leaving us speeches, letters, and verse of dazzling rhetorical skill. Her anguished poem about a suitor's departure is a rare revelation of wounded womanhood behind a queen's frigid mask. I am and not, I freeze and yet am burned, since from myself another self I turned. The search for another self dominates the stories of Shakespeare's sisters. Often the women began writing, as the queen did, behind the veil of translating the poems and theological treatises of others. The browbeaten wife, Elizabeth Cary, created her vibrant verse play, The Tragedy of Miriam, from a radical hack of an ancient Jewish history by Josephus. She dramatizes King Herod's obsession with betrayal through the prism of his unjustly accused wife. The ranting king doesn't even enter until Act 4. In Mary Sidney's case, her voice emerged under the influence of her gifted and much more famous elder brother, the courtier, soldier, poet Philip, who used her as an editorial sounding board and dedicated to her his celebrated pastoral romance, Arcadia. With Mary's help, Philip translated 43 out of the 150 Hebrew Psalms before she was inspired to toss off 107 more of her own with 128 different combinations of stanza and meter. Fear came upon them and sorrow as upon a woman in travail. From the original Hebrew version of Psalm 48 is, Targoff shows us in Mary's version, rendered in the more empathetic voice of a woman who has given birth herself. So they fear, and so they fare, as the wife, whose woeful care the pangs of childbed finds. The great John Donne was among the Psalm's many admirers. Amelia Lanier received no such plaudits for her own remarkable literary efforts. The woman was so erudite, for God's sake, that she dreamed in Latin. The closest she got to high society was as the mistress of the Lord Chamberlain, Baron Hunsdon, son of Anne Boleyn's sister Mary. The book is alive with such juicy incidental details. I had never read that Elizabeth I quietly attempted the restoration of her slain mother's reputation by elevating her extended family at court. Hunsdon kicked Amelia to the curb when she fell pregnant, fobbing her off on a musician as lowly as her own father. Her Salve Dies, an incendiary volume of poetry about Christ's passion, was dedicated to a long list of society women for whose patronage she angled unsuccessfully. Its frank feminist cast probably appalled them. In the Gospel of Matthew, Pontius Pilate's wife is a pass-through one-liner. But in Amelia's poem, she's already a convert to Christ's teaching, who explicitly warns Pilate that the man he's about to crucify is the Son of God. Amelia imbues the wife of the Roman governor with powerful agency, arguing not only for Christ's release, but for liberation from the yoke of patriarchy. Your fault being greater, she demands, why should you disdain our being your equals, free from tyranny? Explosively, she calls the sinning Eve simply good and had no power to see. Or, as Targoff puts it, Eve was merely a victim of misinformation. Wow. After its two printings in 1611, Salve Deus fell out of print for the next 360 years, but we hear its passionate, resounding message clearly today. My heart hurts for Amelia Lanier. Targoff's intent is to scrape away the layer of literary obscurity from Shakespeare's sisters and present the Pentimento as transcendent survivors. Their work indeed lives on, and yet I was left with the crushing sensation of women who tried to flee but were buried alive. This review was written by Tina Brown. She is the author most recently of The Palace Papers. Help Wanted by Adele Waldman. The modern workplace contains and fuels so much of our lives. Who are we when we work? What does our work say about us? It's no surprise that fiction writers have increasingly turned to the workplace setting, using it as a reflection of society, its power dynamics and cultural shifts, as well as a source of characters' private ambitions, disillusionments, desires, and fears. In Help Wanted, her long-anticipated follow-up to The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P., Adele Waldman applies her sharp sense for relational drama and dark comedy to the retail workspace. The novel is set at a branch of Town Square, a big-box store not unlike Target, in fictional Potterstown, New York, a stand-in for the many economically distressed areas in the Southern Tier and Hudson Valley. It's become a popular summer destination for a certain type of city person, the kind who eschewed or was priced out of the Hamptons. But many residents struggle to find work and stability since IBM left town. Waldman focuses on members of Team Movement at store number 1512 who unload trucks, organize the warehouse, and stock shelves before the store opens. The novel roves among 12 different perspectives, charted at the front in a pseudo-family tree. As Big Will, the store manager, thinks while surveying his crew, the diversity of race, gender, and ethnicity in the faces before him would have filled the headmaster of an elite private school with envy. There's Nicole, a white Potterstown local and the youngest movement member at 23, and Ruby, a black woman in her 40s who has worked service jobs since she was a teenager. Diego, an immigrant from Honduras, prides himself on being competent at work, but struggles in his personal relationships. Val, a young lesbian mom, is ashamed of her position and desperate for professional growth. At times, characters' desires and hardships begin to blend into one another. Multiple movement members struggle with alcohol, are single parents, live with parents or grandparents, and have challenges in their intimate relationships. But this seems partly by design. Help Wanted is structured around the collective, depicting the toll of capitalism on low-wage workers. Hours the team gets, benefits that are cut, occasional free meals handed out, cost-cutting pressure from management, the alluring potential of promotion, the bureaucratic rules from corporate. Every decision at Town Square greatly alters each person's day-to-day life and sense of worth. Waldman is skilled at building momentum and tension through intricacies of plot. The book shines whenever the group is together, concocting plans to better their working conditions, resisting and influencing one another in search of a shared sense of hope. Stealing by Margaret Verbal. On a rural 1950s farm, Kit Crockett, half Cherokee and half white, descended from Davy Crockett, fears her angry father and yearns for care. When a misunderstanding turns into a violent dispute, Kit is ripped from her indigenous family and forced to attend a Christian boarding school, where the brutal abuses of power cannot quash her determination to resist. Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking by Mehdi Hassan. The news anchor and journalist who considers argument and debate to be the lifeblood of democracy gives advice on how to change people's minds, from using humor and appealing to pathos to learning to become a better listener as well as speaker. Victory City by Salman Rushdie. Depending on your point of view, the heroine of Rushdie's 16th novel is either a goddess or a girl. When Pompa was 9, a deity began to speak through her, granting her the power to raise a new society from the ground. Over 200-plus years, though, the world Pompa creates into being is one of peace. The story Rushdie tells is about a state that forever fails to live up to its ideals. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.